Council ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
You may.
Thank you, may it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Holland, Justice Ridgely, good morning. We are here today to consider a conviction which resulted from a non-jury trial held before President Judge Cooch in the Superior Court, where at the conclusion of the trial, Judge Cooch found the defendant guilty of, among other things, murder in the second degree. And the murder in the second degree conviction is really the only conviction which is being challenged on appeal. There were two counts of reckless endangering, driving during suspension, and an assault conviction, which also resulted from this prosecution, and those convictions are not at issue. The sole issue, raised by the appellant and by myself in the oral in the brief, is whether or not there was sufficient evidence to sustain the conviction for murder in the second degree. And counsel is, of course, mindful of the heavy burden on an appellant under these circumstances, and is, of course, familiar with the court's decisions in terms of the standard of review that's applied to a sufficiency of the evidence argument. However, I would like to suggest to the court that there are a couple of things about this case which hopefully prompted the oral argument in the matter, which differentiate it from almost every murder second degree conviction which I've researched and which this court has had occasion to deal with in the past, arising out of vehicular homicides. As the court is aware, and indeed counsel conceded at the trial level, these are not the greatest facts in the world. The defendant, as the court knows, has a history of 13 prior violations and 9 moving violations. The court is familiar with the counseling programs which the defendant had been involved in, and is also aware of the fact that the defendant had been admonished by a police officer and a judge regarding his driving in the past. The evidence at trial, and this is one of the main reasons why we went non-jury, is largely indisputed in terms of the speed with which the defendant was operating. And indeed, the expert witness testified that the pre-impact speed, I believe, could have been between 93 and 103 prior to the braking, and then between 88 and 98 subsequent to the braking. So there was a high speed. But what is missing in this particular case, which is present in the Moorhead case and the Seacrest case and the other cases which the lower court considered, is an absence of any drugs or alcohol. Most of the cases that this court has considered, Moorhead, Lilly, Seacrest, and in none of those cases, I might add, as I read the opinions, in none of those cases was there an argument made that there was insufficient evidence with regard only to the prong of murder in the second degree, which constitutes cruel, wicked, and depraved indifference.
Well, Mr. Maurer, in your brief, you make the distinction that there are no drugs and alcohol here. You seem to suggest that the defendant tried to slow down at these controlled intersections. However, as you just indicated, even slowing down, the speed at the time of impact was between 88 and 98 miles an hour. So that doesn't seem to ameliorate things too much.
Well,
you slow down to 98 miles an hour.
I concede that that was the evidence, and we didn't contest the speed here. And the only focus of this appeal really goes to the issue regarding cruel, wicked, and depraved indifference and how that applies under these factual circumstances. The prosecutor in the lower court and in this court has argued that in some ways the absence of drug or alcohol exacerbates the problem or makes it worse, which what's missing in this case is that a person who consumes alcohol or has taken drugs or has drugs in their system, we submit, has a heightened culpability based upon the fact that they get in the car in the first place and they show a lack of concern and an insouciant attitude towards society by just getting in a car after having been drinking and after having used drugs. We didn't have this in this case.
Would be helpful is if you take those three words and just say, it's not cruel because.
Okay.
It's not wicked because, and it's not depraved because. Because what you're saying is, given these facts, as a matter of law, the person didn't commit this crime.
Correct. That is our argument. And I'll try to do that. Using the language that this court has used in other cases, the courts have defined cruel as an intentional or malicious infliction of physical suffering. And we would submit, obviously, there was nothing intentional here. Malicious is a term of art, which I like to kind of, a word I was thinking of on the ride down here was malevolence. This particular defendant, and looking again at the word cruel, it's one of the most puzzling cases I've ever seen. This is not a high-speed chase involving a prior felony that was committed. It's not a person who was really wanted for crimes. All he did was commit a traffic infraction. And leaving aside the propriety of a high-speed chase under those circumstances, his license was suspended. So in that respect, and I think it's been conceded by all, and it was at the trial court level, there was no intent ab initio, if you will, to do this. He was a 22-year-old kid who had not been drinking, had not been using drugs.
When you say do this, what do you mean? When you use the phrase, not his intent to do this, what do you mean by do this?
Do this was...
cause a death?
Cause a death, yes.
It was his intent to drive at the speeds he did to elude the police, to go through controlled intersections at a high rate of speed.
I believe that I have to concede that that was an intentional act and a voluntary act, as the cases require.
With regard to the cases, you've cited two Pennsylvania cases.
Yes, sir.
To which, in the state's answering brief, I saw no reply. And perhaps we'll hear something at argument about why those cases are distinguishable. But I do note that the Pennsylvania cases refer to the recklessness must be such that the life-threatening injury is essentially certain to occur. And I saw in the state's answering brief that the references was there was also a reference was virtually assured a disastrous outcome. Now, did the trial judge apply that analysis?
No.
And are you arguing to us that that is legal error that requires at minimum a remand?
I'm arguing that the Pennsylvania cases which I cited are cases that are on point to this kind of a situation, where you have this type of an accident, and those cases did not find the level of maliciousness and cruel, wicked, and depraved indifference under their third-degree murder statute, which they have up there, which the trial judge found in this particular case. And I think in the Pennsylvania cases, there was an absence, again, of alcohol and drugs, but rather accidents which occurred on the roadway resulting from admittedly reckless driving. And we're not asking for a remand for a new trial. Obviously, the only thing that we're trying to do here is to try to persuade the court that under these facts and under these circumstances, murder second degree, which is an extremely serious charge, is not the appropriate charge under these facts and circumstances. And to go back to Justice Holland's question, if I might, wicked is a bad or evil morality, which the cases say. I submit to the court that it's not reasonable to find under these facts, given this person and this type of person, that that's what we have here. And depraved is a person who ceased to care for human life. Also, the court is, of course, familiar with the Black's Law Dictionary definition, which was cited in Waters versus State, where a depraved mind is an inherent deficiency of moral sense and rectitude. These are words reserved for almost the highest degree of potential criminal culpability. and I'm not in making this argument trying to deprecate, of course, or denigrate the life of the individual who was killed here, nor am I trying to countenance the conduct of the defendant. We admit that he was reckless, that he was aware of his recklessness, that it could cause death, and that it certainly raised that question, but not raised the question, but certainly he was reckless with regard to that issue. The next step that has to be followed here is, was he cruel, wicked, and depraved? And when I think of that concept and when I read that language and you look at the facts of this case, we have a young man who admittedly has the bad prior driving record, but who also, excuse me, as the court saw from the sentencing and from the other papers, he doesn't have a criminal record. He's a 22-year-old who, according to the testimony, panicked, made a bad mistake, took off, and was aware of the risk that he was creating, never dreamed that this was going to happen. And I don't quite agree with what the Supreme Court in Pennsylvania said when they said that the presence of that one vehicle in that location was serendipitous and that's all that happened. But at the same time, this court can exercise its appellate function in deciding whether or not these facts fit what this court has required in murder second-degree prosecutions. As I mentioned earlier, I didn't see this issue raised in Lilly or Waters or Seacrest or another case which probably should have been cited, which is along the same line, it's a case called Chambers versus State, that the sufficiency on cruel, wicked, and depraved indifference was not raised in those particular cases. Again, responding to Justice Holland, there was some testimony, excuse me, from the other passenger in the car, and indeed corroborated by Patrolman Ryan to a certain extent, that as the defendant approached the controlled intersections, he would slow down, albeit not a lot and not enough. That is different, I would submit to the court, than somebody who doesn't do that. He is looking out somewhat, albeit slightly, for the concern for the safety of other individuals, thinking that he could go. It's not a situation where he just shot through every red light without checking what was going on or checking what was coming from either direction, just like when he went through the neighborhood initially, the Newport neighborhood, when the police officer was following him. So, yes, sir.
I have three questions.
Yes, sir.
I hate to interrupt you, but
sorry.
I need to get to these. In the trial judge's remarks, which constitute his opinion in the transcript, there are two issues I'd like to address. The first is, he says at page 29, after reciting wicked, bad, or evil morality as the standard for second degree, he says, of course, all those three words, cruel, wicked, and depraved, are adjectives. They all apply to the noun clause, indifference to human life. Then he goes on to say, by contrast, of course, manslaughter involves all of those elements, but without the element of conscious disregarding the risk that conduct would cause death, and the risk being so great that a reasonable person under the circumstances would have had or acted otherwise. First, is that a correct statement of the law?
No.
And secondly, is it a reasonable person that you look at not for whether someone would have consciously disregarded the risk of death to someone else based on his actions, but when you're looking at second-degree murder and you're trying to figure out whether someone acted in a cruel, wicked, or depraved way, are you looking into that person's mind at the time, or are you looking into the mind of a reasonable person under those circumstances? I mean, what defines those three adjectives that he identified? The way the ordinary person would or would not have acted, or this individual based on that individual's characteristics?
We tried, we argued in our brief that it was this individual based upon this individual's characteristics. Of course, as in all situations like this, against the backdrop of the reasonable person, it's this defendant's state of mind. It's this person with all the frailties that he suffered, as evidenced by Dr. Finkelstein's testimony.
Well, as to Dr. Finkelstein's testimony, it looks like on page 27 of the transcript that the trial judge reviewed it, but I never saw him conclude anything about it. How did he just simply recite it, or did he find that it did or did not have any impact on the defendant's state of mind?
I believe from my review of the transcript and of his decision, which I reviewed again yesterday, is, as a matter of fact, I remember when he started talking about Dr. Finkelstein, I thought that things were going favorably towards the defendant, but he just sort of stopped. And I don't think he rejected it.
Well, but what did he – I can't find a conclusion from it one way or another.
There wasn't.
I can't find a statement that he rejected it because it's not relevant, because we're talking about the reasonable person here, not the idiosyncratic nature or behavioral pattern of the individual who was involved, or vice versa. Then the final question I have is at the bottom of page 30, in reciting what he believes the Waters and the Winsett case stand for, he says, the court goes on to say that where the fatal act was unlawful and cruel and voluntarily committed without adequate provocation, and in circumstances showing a wicked indifference to human life or with a reckless disregard of the consequences, the law, the transcript says applies, but I assume he said implies, malice. Is that correct?
I don't believe that's a correct statement of the law either.
He doesn't say and. He says
or
a reckless disregard. That's manslaughter, isn't it?
Reckless disregard, I would agree, is manslaughter. That's a separate test that's applied.
Okay.
So I guess that really wasn't argued strongly in the brief itself, but that's the problem in this particular area of the law, and Your Honor raises a good point, and actually it's one that I didn't raise and hadn't given a tremendous amount of thought until being right here, and that is it a subjective state of mind that's applied to the concept of cruel, wicked, and depraved indifference, which I don't think we have a whole lot of law, if any, in this jurisdiction on that point.
I read the briefs in total and the transcript from the rulings to suggest that that another argument is you simply look at the facts of what occurred and you imply from those facts that they are so tragic or awful or bizarre that satisfies the standard of cruel, wicked, and depraved simply by the conduct itself. But in my mind, to be frank, and I'm sure Mr. Wallace will address it, it's up in the air about whether that makes sense or not.
Okay.
When you make the distinction between manslaughter and murder second, which is not an inconsequential distinction.
Well, it's a huge distinction, as the court saw in the sentence that's imposed on this
young man. Did you want to save the balance of your time?
Oh, yeah, I have 2 minutes, yeah. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
May it please the court. Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Ridgely, good morning. I am Paul Wallace. I am here for the state of Delaware, the appellant in this matter. I'd like to answer the court's, Justice Steele's question first, the last question that the court had, relating to how do we measure whether or not whether someone's act, their recklessness, manifests a cruel, wicked, and depraved indifference. What do we look to? And I think we need look no further than the code commentary, because it tells us exactly what was expected in developing whether or not someone, or determining whether or not someone manifests that cruel, wicked, and depraved indifference. The commentary at page 191 and 192 says that it will be a jury, or in this case a judge, in each case that will determine whether a killing is so serious in its circumstances as to amount to second-degree murder or is only manslaughter. The distinction is one of degree only. And it goes on to say that decision turns on the actor's conduct. The state will need to prove precisely what the defendant did, which supports its contention that his attitude to human life was cruel, wicked, and depraved. That is, looking from the outside and using a reasonable person standard. The state always need prove that the defendant acted recklessly, and in the case of murder in the second degree, recklessly to the extent that his recklessness was manifesting a cruel, wicked, and depraved indifference to human life, but it's the activity.
Your position is consistent with what I suggested at the end of my question, that you look to the actor's conduct You don't look to the state of mind to add the three elements, if you want to call them that, that tip manslaughter into second-degree murder. It's the actual committed acts that you examine to see whether they were cruel, wicked, and depraved.
I believe so. And I
or
believe
from them you imply cruelty, wickedness, and depravity.
Because it is always hard to determine what's going on in one's state of mind. Certainly in this case, for instance, the defendant testified, here's what was going on in my mind. However, that's months later with the ability to try to say, look, I didn't mean to do X, Y, and Z. And nobody's saying he meant to kill someone.
Well, would that make that testimony then irrelevant?
I suggest it's not irrelevant. I would suggest it is relevant.
What element of the offense did it go to?
It can go to, one is reckless when one is aware of and consciously disregards a risk. Perhaps a defendant's testimony may in some circumstances go to the awareness portion of this. In this case, it's hard to say that the defendant's testimony in this case could go to the awareness portion of it, although that's what they brought in Dr. Finkelstein for in his testimony, because they wanted to say he's somebody who doesn't grasp this.
Can we fairly infer from this transcript, in your view, by that I mean the trial judge's ruling, that he simply recited the medical testimony and then said he didn't accept it or it didn't apply for some reason, or he just simply recited it? What significance did he place on it, if any?
Quite honestly, I remember sitting in the courtroom and felt the same way that Mr. Maurer did, and I said, this looks better for the defendant than it does for the state as he recited it. But I believe that the judge took it into consideration, but obviously did not give it much weight. I don't know that he did. He did not tell us what weight specifically he ascribed to it.
I thought maybe I'd missed something. So apparently both you and Mr. Maurer agree that he recited the testimony, but he reached no conclusion one way or another about its significance.
As I reread the transcript, I'd have to say that's true. The way he then moved from it quickly, it seemed to me that he was reciting it, saying, I've seen it, I've given it consideration, but not telling us what the specific weight was. Obviously, our belief was, being as he found murder in the second degree, he didn't believe that it had excused the defendant's recklessness or had excused his or made doubt be cast on whether or not he was aware of and consciously disregarding a risk. And in fact, to the extent that he was manifesting a cruel, wicked, and depraved indifference. the state, many of the facts are not in dispute in this case. It is true that when we look at other cases of murder in the second degree that involve vehicular deaths, that alcohol seems to be a common thread. But it's not a necessary thread in any way, shape, or form, the state suggests. One would be hard-pressed to find a set of circumstances and a defendant with a background who should have been aware of and of the risk that he was creating. This is somebody who had numerous moving violations, and the state suggested some of the other jurisdictions' cases, mainly because we had a 404B argument beforehand, or at least a motion in limine about it, because a la Moorhead in this state where prior DUIs have something to do or say something about someone's awareness and their conscious disregard. The state suggested that the same was true in this case, and the defense ended up agreeing, and we presented that information to the court.
So there's no issue about the admissibility of that evidence in this appeal?
No. No, actually there was an agreement prior to trial that would be admissible. One of the reasons that we went with a bench trial, everybody understood that is somewhat prejudice. There is, you know, a level of prejudice that one needs guard against, but that a court, a trial judge sitting alone can better weigh sometimes if one gets concerned about a jury misusing it. Well, I don't think there's any argument that there was misuse of it in this case.
Say moves this from manslaughter to second-degree murder? What facts are here? You know, is it the fact that he was going 88 to 98 rather than 60? Is it his prior record? Is it the conversation with the passenger? You know, we're being asked to look at this as a matter of law. And the way I understood your initial answer, you said, well, it's really a matter of degree. We just put the facts out there, and we leave it up to the trier of fact to pick manslaughter or murder in the second degree. But yet, you still have to be able to articulate a legal basis to submit it to the trier of fact. So, you know, we've talked about Sechrist and the other cases, and we take out alcohol and drugs, which you say are not determinative. But what moves this from manslaughter to murder?
Your Honor, if the court had asked of the appellant, if we tried to take those three words, those that describe the degree of recklessness, and that's really what cruel, wicked, and depraved does, it describes the degree of recklessness. First of all, is it cruel in that Mr. Maurer mentioned the first part of the definition of cruel that's accepted in Smith, or at least the jury instructions language was. Was there unnecessary infliction of pain upon the body or feelings or emotions? Was there unnecessary infliction of bodily pain on somebody in this case? Certainly. There was no need for this to happen.
Well, that's true in manslaughter in every case, isn't it? There's no need for it to happen.
There is no need for it to happen, but when someone makes it so much more likely that it will happen, and in this case, certainly, Jason McKinley was simply going to kill someone sooner or later, as the police and the judge told him. But on this particular night, from the time he left, left the area of Newport, when he had almost hit Officer Ryan, and he says that didn't happen, Officer Ryan and the judge found something happened that he swerved in a way that made Officer Ryan concerned as he was speeding first there. All the way through this chain of events, at any point he could have stopped.
So, going back to my question, we're talking about the number of controlled intersections that he went through.
Number, the speed, his knowledge from beforehand, the fact that he had, he was a suspended person at the time. He had been through at least two counseling sessions with DMV. He had been through a behavioral modification course with DMV, the materials of which were put before the judge, to show this is somebody who's been told about his driving. He had a warning from a police officer and a judge just months before. Right, stop this or you will kill someone.
Let's assume hypothetically everything in this case is exactly the same except the accident occurs at the first intersection. He doesn't do multiple intersections, but he's going 100 miles an hour, slows down to 88 to 98, and the person's killed at the first intersection. Would this be second-degree murder?
That's a harder call, quite honestly, Your Honor. I don't know. What I do know is this, and I can only – I know the court would love for me to answer that, and it's hard to tell.
What I'm trying to do is look at the common denominators that – would establish a factual basis for submitting it to the jury. And so far you and Mr. Maurer have said in the past it seems like drugs and alcohol were important. Now we have a case without drugs and alcohol. So if we're going to write an opinion that says drugs and alcohol are not determinative, we still need to somehow identify facts that would distinguish second-degree murder from manslaughter.
Well, in this case, Your Honor, I would suggest that those facts are similar to in Moorhead to some extent. In this case, we have a if we take the appellant's view that it is his particular state of mind and we could only look at his particular state of mind, and we must prove his state of mind, and we don't disagree with that, but take the reasonable person out of it for just a moment, the facts to belie in this case is this is somebody who has specific knowledge and awareness because of his past, because of the things that he had gone through. Let's substitute that for the alcohol, because in cases like Lilly, for instance, or Sechrist, we didn't have that. But in this case, instead, what we have is somebody who's been specifically warned. Perhaps that's it. And the problem is, and I know that it's hard to write, this is the fact pattern that will always meet murder in the second degree, but I would suggest respectfully that certainly is a very salient fact in this particular set of circumstances. Maybe we take out alcohol, but what do we have instead? What we have instead is somebody who has been warned time and time again and gotten a warning that almost no one gets. You will kill someone, from somebody sitting in a robe on a bench saying, you've got to knock this off.
Well, Well, your answering brief says that the defendant's actions virtually assured a disastrous outcome. And that sounds an awful lot like the Pennsylvania cases that Mr. Maurer has cited, particularly O'Hanlon, which says that recklessness must be such life-threatening injury is essentially certain to occur. So what is the role of that analysis in determining whether there's a cruel, wicked, and depraved indifference to human life?
Well, Your Honor, I think we were using a term of art. That's not a phrase that is found in Delaware law nearly as much as it's trying to describe what had happened in this case. However, if we look at the Pennsylvania cases, and specifically O'Hanlon, actually that was not a murder case. That was an aggravated assault case. And in fact, the element in O'Hanlon was that it's extreme indifference to the value of human life. Only one adjective. It's unclear as to what how that would apply directly into Delaware. There, they keep the malice aforethought or implied malice idea. We keep it to a certain extent, but I would suggest that malice aforethought or implied malice is not the whole of what is cruel, wicked, and depraved indifference. The commentary says we've scrapped that idea. We've taken on cruel, wicked, and depraved indifference because it is somewhat easier. You can take those direct words and define them.
But that's how malice was defined in Winsett, wasn't it?
Yes, in part. I would suggest the O'Hanlon case is really of very little use, and the fact that the state described his course of activity as virtually assured to cause a death or virtually assured to cause a fatal outcome, I think is more of a description of his overall course of conduct than
your position that while not legally required in the analysis, that set of facts certainly satisfies.
Yes.
The cruel, wicked, and depraved.
Yes. I'd suggest that it does, because when you look at the course that Jason McKinley had put into effect even before that night, because you have to take into consideration what he knew when he decided to engage in this voluntary conduct. When he was being warned, and another factor, if we got back to Justice Holland's cases, if it's not the conscience of him that tells him no, it's the passenger who does. Somebody who's telling him, just pull over and take the ticket. And instead, he decides, sit back and put on your seatbelt. He knew the danger, and right then and there said no. I mean, that is another fact that's different than, for instance, a Seacrest or a Lily or a Moorhead. And I would suggest substitutes, perhaps, for alcohol or drug use, if we have to say it can't just be high speed, it can't just be blowing red lights, and there must be something else to it. You got to take the totality.
Does every drag racing case become a murder second case now, where there's a homicide?
No, not necessarily, Your Honor. I mean, it would depend on the person's past. It would depend on their knowledge. It depends on the roadway they're on. It depends on what else they see around them.
To follow up on Justice Holland and Justice Ridgely's questions, which I think signal the problem as we see it, and that is, where do you draw the line between second-degree murder and manslaughter? What are the circumstances that cause that line to be crossed because of the significant difference in the potential penalty for each? If we were to go back to Justice Holland's hypothetical and say we have someone who drives at a high rate of speed, goes through one or two traffic-controlled intersections, strikes another vehicle, and there's a fatality, but that person has no past record or history of being informed that his conduct is unacceptable and that he, if he continues to engage in that conduct, will sooner or later cause someone's death. He's not driving on a suspended license. He panics, as this defendant tried to describe he did, as I understand the transcript, but doesn't have that past history baggage. Would you not still indict for second-degree murder because there was an 80 to 100 mile an hour chase through a neighborhood and two traffic control signal devices were ignored or more, and an innocent person was killed?
I suggest I can't tell the court that there's some specific rubric that the state applies when it's charging. That's certainly closer to manslaughter.
You were just reciting conditions that would apply before one sought or could prove beyond reasonable doubt cruel, wicked, and depraved indifference to human life. Now, how do we write an opinion that doesn't open it up for any case that has more than ordinary facts that show a conscious disregard of the risk of death to someone else being converted into second-degree murder?
Your Honor, the state wasn't trying to set a recipe for future cases as to what it is.
That's unfortunately what we have to do.
I understand that,
that's
Your Honor.
The trouble we're having.
I think that basically what the court can do and should do, the court did in Waters, and that is when it said the cruel, wicked, and depraved indifference can be found when the intentional acts of the defendant were so fraught with danger, so likely to cause death or great bodily harm.
Well, Waters can't be that clear because the trial judge here said that it's cruel when it demonstrates a reckless disregard of the consequences.
I understand that the court's concern.
How clear a beacon can Walters be or Waters be under those circumstances?
I don't think that Waters had specifically described cruel or had defined it as well as Smith certainly did later on, Your Honor. But I'd suggest that that's the line, that Waters is the line, that when someone's intentional acts are fraught with danger and so likely to cause death or great bodily harm. The problem is that the facts are always going to be somewhat different. Some are going to be more mitigating, some will be more aggravating. When we look at this case and you take all of the aggravating circumstances that raise it above mere recklessness, his past, the length of the chase. In this case had the fortune or misfortune, however you want to see it, of the trier of fact actually getting to see the behavior in part because he got to see, the trial judge got to see the videotapes of what was occurring, because one police officer had the camera on and was able to see him go past and able to gauge that type of behavior was wholly out of line, more than mere recklessness. And then actually, unfortunately, see part of the crash because of another videotape.
Well,
it is fact specific.
If that's the case, someone is on tape driving 80 to 100 miles an hour but doesn't cause a fatality. Do you indict them for attempted second degree murder?
Well, I suggest you can't do an attempted reckless act, Your Honor, but could it be reckless endangering to some extent? Depends on the circumstances. Depends on the roadway. Depends on a lot of factors. In this case, some of the other factors that took part, other people were endangered than even the mere eventual victim. There were people who were passed, and that evidence came in. You have to look at all of the factors in this particular case that raise this recklessness far above the norm.
The ultimate penalty that the defendant got, the sentence, was within the parameters of manslaughter, wasn't it?
Yes, it would have been. Thank you, Matt.
Mr. Maurer?
I only have 2 minutes, Your Honor, so I'll be relatively brief. Yeah, I think manslaughter is 2 to 25, so I think the judge would have been within his power to give the same sentence even if it was a manslaughter conviction, even though the guidelines are different for it. I guess the only two comments I wanted to make, while the court was speaking, I went back and looked at Judge Cooch's analysis of Dr. Finkelstein's testimony, and he basically doesn't say anything about it. He only said it helps me understand the defendant's state of mind better, but didn't say he didn't accept it, reject it, whatever. That's number one. Number two, I guess the puzzling puzzling part about the state's argument is the concession that if the accident had happened at the first red light at a time when the evidence was that the defendant was going, at least the lay testimony, was anywhere from 80 to 100 miles an hour, and I'm not quite sure how I understand that to be any different. And that takes us back to the Pennsylvania case where the word serendipitous was used. If the car was present at the first red light
as opposed to the third red light, I'm hearing the state saying that the case may not have been indicted as a second-degree murder case, notwithstanding the prior incidents and the warnings and the things of that nature, which shows the difficulty, I guess, that you will have articulating standards in this type of situation.
But doesn't that relate to, because there wouldn't be the same amount of evidence to show the state of mind that you get from going through several intersections as opposed to just one?
Well, I don't know why going through several is any worse than going through one in terms of the speed that you're traveling at. There could be a car at the first one as there was at the third one. So I don't know that I agree with that necessarily. And my very last point is we did stipulate to the prior activities because it was our position that they went to the issue of recklessness, not to the issue of cruel, wicked, and depraved indifference. The defendant's aware of the risk and his conscious disregard. Amen.
Mr. Maurer, before you sit down, tell us the implications of the appeal for your client if you prevail. Many times we'll see cases where there's some collateral civil consequences or someone doesn't want to be convicted of a felony as opposed to a misdemeanor. But if we conclude as a matter of law this was a manslaughter case and your client's going to get the same sentence, are there any other consequences for your client that we don't know about?
No.
And so
there is a civil suit, but...
Well, and that probably won't change, but they're both felonies. And
they are.
What has your client accomplished other than a hope that if there's a resentencing on manslaughter, the judge might impose a different sentence, even though this sentence was imposed based on operative facts that are not in dispute?
Okay. This sentence was mandatory. I mean, the judge had no choice. So that incident that you're talking about would be a hope on our client's part and on our part that the judge, if he had discretion, would consider Dr. Finkelstein's testimony and other things about the defendant's lack of prior record and impose a less significant sentence. But on another point, this defendant has now been branded for the rest of his life as a murderer. There's a big difference between a manslaughter conviction and what it implies to the public and what it says about the human being and somebody who's been a murderer for a vehicular homicide.
But the primary consequence would be that there would not be a mandatory sentence.
Correct. From a practical point of view.
Thank you, counsel, for a very interesting argument. We'll take the case under advisement. Recess.